Some wives still marvel at the ability of their combat veteran husbands to see everything in life after the war as a dividend. One of those wives is Dorothy A. Talbot of Golden, Colorado. She writes, "My husband John is almost 76 years old, was a Depression kid who went to New Mexico Military Institute in the 30s, courtesy of a great uncle, then to OCS, and then on to the 10th Mountain Division at Camp Hale, Colorado. He got there because he had worked with horses at the New Mexico Military Institute, so he was sent to Camp Hale as a mule officer, only to discover that they had done away with mules sometime before. So they put him in a line company because he'd written on his info sheet that one of his hobbies was skiing, even though he'd only been once. He was transferred out before the 10th went overseas as a replacement officer in the Massachusetts National Guard and eventually to the Battle of the Bulge in Europe. He was wounded. His helmet saved his life from a hand grenade. And after recovering in England, was with the occupation forces and spent some time in Munich as a censor for a German newspaper. I am 70 years old, was also a Depression kid, whose banker father had lost everything in the crash. I, however, was in high school during the war and graduated in 1946, and am appalled now at how unaware I was while the war was going on. We didn't have TV then, of course, and I suppose I was a typical teenager, not terribly interested in much beyond my own small world. The real purpose of this letter is to tell you that until I read your book, I never really understood the impact that the war must have had on my husband. I am sure that his experiences in military school and the Army molded his character like nothing else, and it explains why he has conducted himself with such courage, battling a neuromuscular disease for the past 42 years. He was diagnosed with a form of muscular dystrophy called spinal muscular atrophy when he was 34. It was very slow progressing, and he even skied until he was in his 50s. However, he's been quite disabled for the past 10 years or so and can do very little for himself. He was a stockbroker when diagnosed, thank goodness, because he didn't have to change occupations. He's just made his living on the telephone all these years and is still working, although finally has decided to retire at the end of the year. He's truly an inspiration to all who know him because he's always cheerful, never complains, and only occasionally gets angry at something he can't do, but only I overhear that. So this has been truly the biggest battle of his life, and he has managed it remarkably well with great dignity and grace. I think that his war experiences really pale in comparison because this has gone on so long. World War II may have been the last great age of the love letter. Love letters have been written since, but never on such a scale. Mail call for those in uniform and the daily postal delivery for those at home were cherished rituals of life. Those letters brought news of family, neighborhood gossip, confessions of loneliness and fear, expressions of sympathy from commanding officers for families whose young men were wounded or dead, the full spectrum of human emotion, but most of all, love. Patricia M. Dorff of Staten Island, New York, shared a collection of letters exchanged by her parents during the war. She writes, "Both my parents grew up on Staten Island just a few doors from one another. They attended the same grammar and high schools. When my father started Columbia University in 1935, my mother got a job in Manhattan. It was not until senior year in Columbia did my father start his courtship with my mother. In 1939, my father started Columbia Law School. Probably one of the most magical days was August 23, 1941, when they were married. Then, the draft took him away to boot camp in July 1942. My father was sent overseas in July 1943. My parents wrote almost every day. They not only wrote what was happening in their personal lives, but their hopes, dreams, fears, and most profoundly, their love and dedication to one another. My father died at a young age in 1962. My mother raised the three of us, always looking in the best side of life and instilling in us honesty, compassion, and to live life to the fullest. No one could ever understand why my mother never dated or remarried. She had a lot to offer someone. It was not until I read all the hundreds of letters that they wrote to each other during the war that I realized that my father was my mother's one true love. No one could ever take his place. Roger Dorff's nickname for his wife Sophie was Joe. This is a letter that he wrote in August 1944. Dear Joe, I have shown your very fancy salutation to the proper people and they are impressed. Must be convinced that you love me more than their gals love them. And incidentally, I know that they know that much as they may like some female, they can't even get near the way I feel about you. They should anyway, because I mention it often enough. I suppose that my attitude may become boring to them at times, but I have to tell someone about it, don't I? I have just heard a very familiar cry, a chorus by my friends who have just walked into the office. It is, "Dear Sophie." That happens every time they see me at the typewriter. So you want to know what nights I go riding in the Jeep. If I could count on meeting you, I would make it any night or any day. I would even walk. 1 year's being alone when it hits you all at once hurts a little, doesn't it? Why feel sad? I'm going down and take a look at your picture. As long as I have you, nothing can be really wrong. All my love. At home, Sophie was volunteering to wrap bandages for the Red Cross, a vital chore that went on everywhere in America. Here is a letter she wrote to Roger in August 1944. My darling Roger, I'm very tired. It's 11:30, but I could not go to sleep without telling you how many dressings we made tonight. We broke all records, 3,094 dressings for 21 workers in 3 hours. That's impossible, but we did it. I'm a slave driver, you know me. Roger, dear, the RC ladies all approve of your pictures. I'm getting such pleasure out of them, dear. You sure minded all of my instructions. I could just see you saying Sophie wants me to smile and look pleasant. You are an angel to do me such a favor. Good night, my darling one. I love you so very much. Kiss me, your own dear Sophie. Here is a letter from Roger to Sophie dated in early August 1944. Dear Sophie, this is one letter you probably won't get for a long time, so now that you finally have it, I hope it lives up to your expectations. At the moment, I am relaxing on a bunk with two more bunks over my head. Altogether, there are 9 first lieutenants in this one stateroom, but we are getting along pretty well. Maybe you've already guessed where I am. Correct. On a boat. Name, capacity, location, etc. All military secrets. I think I can say it is not moving. But censorship does not affect my saying that I love you, does it? That's no military secret. In fact, it's no secret at all. I keep loving you more and more, and now I'm really beginning to miss you. Roger to Sophie, August 26, 1944. Dear Sophie, okay, don't go hitting me on the head. This will have to represent the letters for the 24th and 25th, too. First of all, I am not where I used to be, but I am still not sure where I am going. But since I won't be able to mail this anyway until we land, it's okay to say that it will be someplace in France. Now, don't you start chewing on your nails. Of course, I don't actually know anything. I've seen my first proof of how well the Allies have this sector of the world under control. It's amazing to see the number of ships plying back and forth, just like a busy highway back home. It looks as though England ought to be emptied soon if it keeps up. Remember what I said earlier. No worrying. I honestly can say that. And I love you very much and miss you even more. All my love, Roger. Sophie to Roger, September 19, 1944. Do you miss me today? I sure miss you. I had an experience today. I think that I really hit bottom this morning. My nerves were all shot to pieces and I was shaking like a leaf. When Gussie called to say that there was a letter from you, I was completely cured. What do you think it is, Snooks? Love? I'm getting pretty certain of the fact that I love you so much. Of course, the news about Kent's death last night upset me quite a bit. I still don't realize it, even though I can say it. Roger to Sophie, September 22, 1944. Dear Sophie, the letters are still arriving all out of order. The latest batch that I have to report are those of the following dates, August 26th, 29th, 30th, and 31st. And for all of them, my sincerest thank yous. Letters from you are the nicest things that I can get in France or England or any place else that you might think of. Just as soon as I get all of them gathered together out of my various shirt pockets and field jackets, I am going to line them up in order and read them all over again, just to get a clear picture of what you were really doing the last few weeks of August. I had about 10 minutes' worth of business out around Versailles today, so Rose and I went out, took care of the business, and then took in the chateau, or whatever it should be called. Gosh, hon, how I wish you could be here to get to places like that with me. Sophie to Roger, June 19, 1945. Roger, dear. How's my favorite friend this fine day? I've thought it all over very carefully and just decided that I like you more than anyone else in the whole wide world and want you home soon. Gets lonesome without you. Today is the day that New York City is welcoming Eisenhower. If it had been a regular parade, I'd have gone, but it was only a motorcade. Zip, and it's over. Give me the old-fashioned kind of parade, where the big shot sits on the steps of St. Patrick's and watches the show go by. On Friday, darling, it will be 3 years that you are in the U.S. Army. That was your induction date, remember? Also, 3 years out of law school. 3 years on the 29th that you were admitted to the bar. Such a world. Does it seem real to you that we will be married 4 years by the end of summer? Our little Susan is rapidly becoming a big Susan. We're going to weigh her again tonight. She is a doll, and I love her. At first, they sleep about 23 hours of the day, but now she's awake for a few hours at a time and just lies still. No weeping, no nothing, just kicking and eating. I'll say so long for a while, my pet. You are my most favorite darling pet, and I wish you were here because I'd like very much to neck with you. Your own dear Joe. Roger and Sophie, Joe, did find their way back into each other's arms after the war, and as their daughter says, their romance continued. In their wartime expressions of love and concern, and in their marriage, till death do us part, they were emblematic of a generational romance. When I shared some of these stories with a friend, he was moved, and then, after a moment, he commented on the nature of the world in which we live. You hear something like that, and you resolve to keep it in your mind forever, but 20 minutes later, you're wondering, what's for lunch? It was a thoughtful and perceptive comment on the pace of modern life and the personal agendas that preoccupy too many of us. Nonetheless, the stories in The Greatest Generation did strike a chord with many readers. Their response was uncomplicated and heartfelt. Both members of that generation and those who came later seemed grateful for the opportunity to say thank you without apology or condition. Those expressions of appreciation came in a variety of forms and across generational lines. Harold W. Duckett of Wisconsin wrote about how he felt after being thanked by a Vietnam veteran at a recent Memorial Day parade. I am 76 years old, a veteran of the European Theater of Operations, and went into Omaha Beach on the 14th of July, 1944, when the Germans were just 6 miles inland. This past week ago Monday, my wife and I attended the Memorial Day services at a small town in Wisconsin. As was my custom, I wore my Eisenhower jacket, which I can get on but can't button, with my T5 rating on the sleeve along with 4 gold stripes for 2 years overseas and the few ribbons I picked up along the way, and my overseas cap. I stood at the right times and saluted at the right times. As we got up to leave, an Army officer from the Vietnam conflict, who had been on the band shell as one of the speakers, came up to me and said, "I saw you in your uniform, and I just wanted to say thank you." It was later on that day when I realized he hadn't said, "Thank you for coming to the ceremonies," or "Thank you for being here." He just said, "Thank you." As I approached the 55th anniversary of my going ashore in France, I must say, this is the first time anyone ever said thank you for what we assumed was just our duty and obligation. William Bud Anthony of Muldrow, Oklahoma, was a child of the Depression whose life was changed by military service. He writes, "I too have buried my memories of my life in the 40s. First, poverty, We had a dirt floor in our one-room house. A man, woman, and 8 children. I was the oldest, and when I turned 17 years old, I enlisted in the Army. This was the first time I had more than 1 pair of shoes and more than 2 pair of pants. I remember telling the supply sergeant, "What am I going to do with all these clothes?" He replied, "Keep moving, soldier." That was the first time anyone had called me soldier. I still think about how I swelled up with pride. At that early age in our lives, we trusted everyone, and anyone older was Mr. or Mrs. Respect was coveted and demanded. Trust was part of our lives. If we were asked, if we did something, we never thought of denying it. Good moral character was the only way we knew. I didn't realize we were poor until I went into the service. I know in my heart that if we hadn't gone to war, I would not have been successful at anything. President Truman saved my life. We were scheduled to go to Tokyo Bay on the second wave. I feel to this day if he had not dropped the bomb, I would have perished. Yes, I saw Hiroshima. But at that time in my life, I didn't realize what I was looking at. It just looked like nothing had been there for 1,000 years, only cement rubble and devastation. Yes, it killed thousands. But on the other side, we killed thousands and saved a lot more Americans and Japanese than the bomb killed. I'm starting to remember things that I don't want to, so I will close my letter. Herbert Owens of New York City escaped from Vienna in 1938. Austria had been annexed by Hitler, and Herbert's father had already spent a year in a concentration camp. Owens writes about the struggle to survive that refugees faced in New York, and the euphoria he felt on returning to Austria in 1943 as an American soldier and citizen. He told me he considers this his greatest achievement. I was born in Vienna, Austria, in June 1924. My father was the third-generation owner of a drugstore in the center of town. My mother died when I was 8. I attended public school from age 6 to age 10, then entered high school, learning Latin and English. In March 1938, Hitler annexed Austria, the Anschluss. The route into town was down our street. I was then not quite 14. In May 1938, most of the Jewish men were arrested, my father included, and sent to Dachau concentration camp. I lined up at Gestapo headquarters and was told that Hitler wanted all Jews to leave Austria, and as soon as we found a place to go, my father would be released. There were few options. Very few countries opened their doors. Entry to the United States was by a quota system, so I registered for a number. A sponsor was needed. 2 cousins who themselves had just emigrated to the United States based on an employment contract sent us the required affidavit of support in December 1938. Permission to leave Austria could be obtained only by leaving all possessions behind. This meant dealing with financial matters about which I had very little knowledge. Fortunately, a good friend of my father who was not Jewish helped me, and sometime around my 15th birthday, the exit papers were complete. Providence shone on us when shortly thereafter I was notified by the American consulate that our quota number had been reached, the affidavit had been accepted, and that the visa would be issued, subject only to a physical. When I presented this to the Gestapo, they did approve my father's release after he was in prison more than a year, with the proviso that we would leave within 60 days. We almost didn't make it out of Vienna. On September 3, World War II started. Our passage was booked from Trieste, Italy, to New York for early November. We managed to hide out and finally left in time to get the boat, taking only 1 suitcase with clothes and no money. We arrived in November and found a furnished room on the west side. My father got a minimum wage job to deliver packages. I went to high school, also on the west side. It was not easy to make ends meet, so when I was 16, I got working papers and continued high school at night. There were many other refugees, as we were known, attending for the same reasons, including my wife, who I was fortunate to meet there. She, too, coincidentally, had recently come from Vienna. On my 18th birthday, I registered for selective service and was called to active duty in February 1943. I was assigned to Fort Dix for basic training. The very first day, we were taken to federal court in Newark and sworn in as citizens of the United States. After completing the basic training, I was sent to the Signal Corps in Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, to attend radar school. In July 1943, now 19, my wife and I were married. After completing some preliminary courses, we soldiers were trained by engineers from AT&T to operate a new top-secret microwave communication system, which they had just developed for the U.S. military. A unit was formed, and we were sent to Wiesbaden, Germany. The war in Europe ended. The cable and telephone systems were totally destroyed. The chief signal officer happened to come to our compound, looking for personnel who spoke German. Plans were made to rehabilitate German installations somewhat similar to what we had been trained on, located on mountaintops throughout the country. Together with a few other men, I was selected and assigned to General Eisenhower's headquarters with the task to rebuild and operate stations to carry telephone and telegraph traffic. I interviewed prisoners of war, looking for soldiers who had operated this equipment, assembled a crew, established a repair shop, and our team successfully reestablished communications. My travels took me to Frankfurt, Munich, Cologne, and to Vienna. The euphoria of returning as a soldier of my new country just 6 years after leaving remains a lasting memory. My wife and I just celebrated our 75th birthday and our 56th wedding anniversary. Not a day passes without us thinking about our past and how very fortunate we are to live in freedom in the greatest country in the world. Christopher Gillespie, another Vietnam veteran who now lives in Westport Point, Massachusetts, has often reflected on the differences between the experiences of his parents and what he endured. In 1942, my father was a 30-year-old classics teacher, 5 years into his teaching career with one small child and me on the way. He came home from class one day and announced he was joining the Navy. In his school community, there were many young men with families in similar circumstances, none required to go off to war. But my father, along with many of his colleagues, felt strongly that he needed to be a part of this war, so he became a 90-day wonder at Fort Schuyler, New York. Because he stammered badly, the Navy would not let him become a ship's officer, with the difficulty of issuing orders on a bridge, I suppose. Frustrated, he asked for the next most hazardous duty, and he was assigned to the Greenland Patrol. He ended up on a support base in Greenland teaching English to other servicemen. He loved that tour and loved Greenland, sending us back Eskimo crafts and a 45 record he had made, wishing his little family back home a Merry Christmas. My mother, her world turned completely upside down, went bravely along with these developments and had already joined the American Red Cross Motor Corps. There she met her best friend in life, and the two of them were like naughty kids in the back of a classroom. Her circumstances were not unique. All three of her brothers went off to war, two of them going away for at least 4 years. They all made it home eventually, and I remember as a young boy the feeling in our town, a sense of communal homecoming, reunion, getting joyfully back to normal life. I remember wounded veterans panhandling on the sidewalk, the packed Memorial Day parades, and red paper poppies. That clarity of purpose and sense of community makes my tour in Vietnam seem all the more solitary and confused. The differences between my father's war and mine are enormous, ironic and poignant, at least to me. I find myself oddly envying my father's experience. My mother looks back over a long, happy life punctuated by worry, waiting, and wars, waiting for her father to return from the trenches of World War I France, waiting for her brothers and husband to return from World War II, and waiting for me to return from Vietnam. Certain battles symbolize World War II. D-Day tops the list. It was massive, daring, and successful, a critical turning point in defeating Germany. A veteran of the Pacific Theater, Frank G. Nolte of Lincoln Park, Michigan, had a memorable encounter when he finally got to Normandy. He writes, "I took advantage of the GI Bill, earned a graduate degree, and went on to teach at a community college for almost 40 years. I traveled from a new home purchased on the GI Bill benefits and still live in it. No member of my family ever graduated from college before me. I am probably the very typical man you wrote so glowingly of. I went to Omaha Beach in 1988, missing D-Day by about 44 years. I sat alone on the low stone wall that separates the cemetery from the beach, filled with this tremendous emotional upheaval. Our French guide interrupted my moment, and the following conversation ensued. Were you here then? No, Cher. I was in New Guinea on D-Day. But these men, they are your peers? Yes. I know how you feel. How could you, Cher? You were 25, born in Paris, and a graduate of the Sorbonne. How could you know how I feel? Rude, maybe, but given the moment. Down the road a few kilos is another cemetery, she said, where my grandfather is buried. He was shot by the Gestapo on D-Day for having a radio. Not a transmitter, just a radio. Then you do know. Suddenly she said, may I sit with you for a few minutes and hold your hand? I probably nodded, too far into tears to speak. After a few minutes she stood up and said, the tour must move on. Then she said, may I kiss you? My lord, Mr. Brokaw, what is an emotional basket case to do? I kissed her while weeping unashamedly. Do you know the lines from Emerson? When it seemed that the Civil War was nearing, and when by contemporary standards the young men seemed to be fops and weaklings, Emerson wrote, so nigh is grandeur to our dust, so near is God to man. When duty whispers low, thou must. The youth replies, I can. Few children relate easily to the young lives of their parents. Events that precede our own births automatically fall into the category of history, a distant time, however few years have actually passed. For the baby boomers, the army of children produced by the men and women who began their families once the war was over, the disjunction between their world and the world of their parents could hardly have been greater. One represented deprivation, sacrifice, and hard-won prosperity. The other greatly expanded opportunity and, even during Vietnam, more personal choices. Those differences led to some historic and well-documented rifts, indeed to a cultural revolution that since has cooled. Now, based on many of the letters I received, as the boomers grow older, they also become much more aware of what their parents had endured and the legacy of their early challenges. In watching her father care for her mother after a debilitating stroke, Janet McKeon of O'Fallon, Illinois, realized that the strength of their relationship grew out of their war experience. As a member of the early baby boom generation who lived through the Vietnam years, I thought we were the group who had been wronged, with our boyfriends, husbands, fighting in a faraway place in a war that nobody wanted to be part of, and with no appreciation by others of what we went through. Your book certainly gave me a different perspective on that. But that's not all your book did for me. It made me wonder about my own parents' participation in and life during the war. Of course, I knew my dad had served and that my older sister was born during the war, but he never talked about it, and I guess I was never interested enough to ask. Sad to say, but during the past year, my dad and I have had a lot of time to talk since my mother had a stroke and required constant care. I made a 3-hour trip home every week to help with her care, and it was during this time that he started telling me about their life during the war. What an eye-opener these stories were to me. It was hard to believe that in all those years since the war, they had never complained about those hardships, the separations, and the fear of the bombing missions. My dad was a bombardier who flew missions out of England. I had always seen my parents as good, hard-working people, but the year that we cared for my mother showed me their strength, which they obviously also had during the war years. My dad cared for her 24 hours a day, never complaining, always appreciative of the help my sisters and I gave, but never demanding or expecting it. My mother endured the helplessness and, at the end, the hopelessness with quiet dignity until she died in May. My real reason for writing you is to urge you to use your public voice to remind members of my generation who are still lucky enough to have one or both parents alive to listen to their stories before they are lost forever. Mike McRecon of Manville, Texas, wrote to describe a similar experience. My father passed away last year after a 3-year struggle with the effects of a severe stroke. He was at home because of the love and devotion of my mother, his wife of 55 years. My dad was at Pearl Harbor on one of the few ships of the line that was able to escape the sneak attack. For many years, I tried to get my dad to tell me what it was like on that Sunday morning. He never would or could talk about it. It was difficult to read The Greatest Generation without tearing up or being emotionally choked up to know of the hardships, loss, and joy that my parents' generation suffered through. After watching my mother care for Dad since the day of his stroke, I always knew it was because of her unconditional love for him and his deep-seated fear of being placed in a nursing home. But after reading about the many others in The Greatest Generation, I also understand and appreciate more why my parents made the choices and decisions that they did throughout their entire lives together. I met Pat Zack in Louisville, Kentucky, while signing copies of The Greatest Generation. She wanted to tell me more about her father, Paul W. Tittle, Sr. My father served in the 537th Quartermaster Battalion of the U.S. Army. Among other battles and campaigns, he experienced Normandy firsthand. Apparently, his experiences there changed him forever. My father refused or was unable to talk about anything that happened to him or the things that he saw during the war. As children, we thought it would be exciting to hear about how he alone beat the Nazis and the Japanese. He never seemed to understand our childish fascination and would always grow quite serious and change the subject. When we were high schoolers, looking for more insight into the history we studied, he would again become very serious, only confirming or commenting on the facts. When asked for his personal reactions, he would only say, "Just pray that you never live during a world war." In 1984, on the 40th anniversary of D-Day, my father returned to Normandy. I was told that when he stepped onto Omaha Beach and later Utah Beach, he fell to the ground shaking and sobbing like a child. Still, on his return, he would not discuss his reliving of that moment. I was born in 1950, a child during the years of rebuilding after the war. Experienced adolescence throughout the turbulent 60s, established a career in the 70s, became a boomer, and began a family of my own in the 80s and finally reached some level of maturity in the 90s. Throughout all those years, I never really knew or understood how my father became the great man that he was. What I did know was that he never wanted his children or future generations to experience what he did during the war and did all that he could to ensure that the world, at least our world, would be a better place for us. Throughout 16 years of formal education and hours of independent study, none of the U.S. history courses I took, and none of the books I read, gave me the insight into the people who served in World War II as your book did. The stories told in The Greatest Generation, I believe, were my father's stories, the stories that he could never bring himself to tell. Their missions, their goals, their dreams were his. Thank you for writing this book. Thank you for providing me with the opportunity to get to know my father. The parents of the baby boomers are in their 70s and 80s. This is their twilight time. The father of Barbara Yearing of Ridgewood, New Jersey, suffers from terminal cancer. My father was a recent graduate of the University of Illinois in 1943 when he joined the Army Air Corps. He hurriedly got married, and then he and my mother traveled with gas rations from Chicago to California, where he was stationed as a meteorologist. Their experiences during that time organized their thinking and became part of our family history. Today, my father lives a good distance away and is dying of cancer. I had been searching for some way to tell him how much I appreciated my childhood and all that he had done for me, but could not seem to find the words to tell him face to face. My dad, like many of the World War II era, has had a hard time with expressed feelings. He would have found it strange to be thanked for something that was for him a matter of course. That's when I stumbled upon your book and thought I might use it as a Christmas gift and also as a means to open up a discussion with him about his life and what an impact it has had on me. The book captured for me what I have been trying to say to him for some time about the qualities exemplified by his generation, qualities that I have taken for granted all these years: honesty, integrity, hard work, personal responsibility, and perseverance were all around me, and I absorbed them almost imperceptibly. Your book has also helped me to see my father as part of his generation, and not so unusual in his somewhat intractable and unyielding beliefs. So I sent my father your book with a letter that attempted to express my gratitude to him. I tried to let him know that I understood the uniqueness of his time in history and was proud of the way he had come through it all. Mostly, I thanked him for being a great father. He called me on Christmas Day to thank me for the note and to say that it tugged at his heart. He finally heard me, and we were finally able to connect in a meaningful way. Thank you for writing such a wonderful tribute to my father and others like him. Thanks to you, I feel I have been able to say something important to him before he dies. The grandchildren of the greatest generation are hearing these stories of life in the 30s and 40s for the first time. One of them is H. Harrison Wheeler of Village of Gulf, Florida. He greatly admires his grandfather, who served in the Counterintelligence Corps. He writes, "The greatest generation was a recent college graduation gift, along with a generous check from my grandparents, who, it occurred to me as I progressed through the book, could easily have been among those you profiled. The day my grandparents were married in the late 1930s, their collective savings totaled a meager $20. But they loved each other, and they knew how to work. During World War II, my grandfather enlisted and, failing an entrance exam into the Army Air Corps because of poor eyesight, was placed in the relatively thin ranks of the Counterintelligence Corps, a branch of the OSS, I believe. As I have taken an interest in him and his generation, thus the book was an appropriate present, he occasionally opens up to me about the war, a topic that unfailingly piques my curiosity. But even with me, his namesake grandson, he is often reticent and unwilling to discuss his Army days. They were, he says, some of the worst days of his life, and he has no wish to relive them. After the war, he returned home and prospered in the restaurant business in Buffalo and in the Northeast at large, eventually selling his business to Del Monte. Yet, despite his stupendous financial success and his achievements in the war, I know he was decorated in one capacity or another, what my grandfather is most proud of are the five sons he and my grandmother raised and the subsequent families the boys established. My grandfather is the most brilliant, compassionate, reflective person I know. But after having read your book, it seems obvious that many other grandchildren would echo my sentiment to describe their own grandparents." Brian W. Haas of Gainesville, Florida, writes about the sacrifices of his grandfather, who died when he was 2 years old. "I never knew my grandfather, Clarence Kennish, a World War II veteran. I was 2 years old when he died 21 years ago. I often imagine the conversations that we might have had. Unfortunately, as seems to be the case often, he rarely talked about the war. Neither my mom nor her sister knows much about what he did during the war in Europe. The only remembrance I have from my grandfather is his old duffel bag. This is a treasure to me. It contains his Army-issue clothing, toiletries bag, a few pictures, and other small items. It is the only thing I have from him, but I am so thankful to have it. But because of the stories you have gathered, I feel like I know something more about my grandpa. By seeing the people who he likely fought along with, I can better imagine his experiences. I wish that more Americans today would take the time to look back and see the sacrifices these great people made for our great country. Perhaps if they did, they would appreciate more the precious freedom that we enjoy. I am so proud of my grandfather, although he's been gone for over 20 years in a way I feel that he lives on. Every time our flag is raised, our national anthem sung, and freedom is enjoyed, I believe he lives on." Some children of the greatest generation have their own memories of the war years. John E. Smith of Alaska was living in California as a young child. My first memories are of my grandfather, grandmother, aunt, and mom gathered around the radio at night listening to the news. Night after night, this took place. No talking on my part was allowed, as every word was listened to with a gravity I have never since felt. Sometimes the broadcasts were very hard to hear, as there was a great deal of static noise. I still remember looking around at my family and seeing faces so serious that I was afraid. Over time, I learned that my dad was in England, getting ready to fight Hitler. I didn't learn until after the war exactly what he did. I did not find out from him, either. My grandmother had to tell me. My father never spoke to me in any detail about the war. I learned that he was part of the Red Ball Express hauling mostly fuel to Patton. He went to Europe 6 days after D-Day as a buck sergeant and came home a battlefield commissioned captain. After the war, the Army Air Corps became the Air Force, and my father went with the Air Force. The reason we moved to California was also for the war effort. My mother drove a wrecker for the military. My aunt and grandmother were building airplanes, and my grandfather was a tool and die maker, also involved with building airplanes. One of the things that I, to this day, remember clearly is that I once saw a poster for Rosie the Riveter, and she had a blue and white hanky tied around her head. That night when my aunt came home, she was wearing the same hanky around her head, and I thought the poster was of her. I also remember shortages. My grandmother complained the most. Grandma liked to bake, and the two most essential things, butter and sugar, were always in short supply. Many people also talked about gasoline being rationed, but rubber, i.e. tires, was also in short supply. My grandfather was something of a genius in repairing tires that were no good. He had built a little vulcanizer, as he called it. He would recap portions of old tires that other people said were not repairable. I remember VE Day as very confusing. My mother and aunt broke down and cried. My mother was essentially out of control, and no one was able to make her stop crying. I was very scared, and everyone tried to tell me it was because she was so happy, but I could not believe this until much later, when she did stop. My dad finally came home in 1946. I didn't even know him. My father never really spoke to me or anyone about the war. When I asked him about his being commissioned an officer in the field, he only said that they were short of experienced men and that he was most experienced, so they appointed him. He did not like being an officer and resigned his commission in 1946 to become a master sergeant. My father passed away in 1972. His civilian funeral was held in Riverside, California. We then placed his flag-draped casket on a train. My mother was not in good health and could not go with him on the train. I rode with him in the baggage car to San Francisco, where he had a military burial with full honors. This is where I learned about some of what he had done in Europe. I still do not know how his fellow soldiers learned about his funeral, but there were about 15 men there. We spoke a little after the ceremony, and they informed me of his bravery and leadership under fire. Most of these men were in tears, and there was a lot of emotion displayed for a few moments. Then it was suddenly over, and they all, to a man, began to change the subject and start telling jokes. Each seemed to be embarrassed that they had spoken at all. I will never forget that day or those men. I have tears in my eyes now just writing about it. Like you, I was raised by those men and women who rarely spoke of their sacrifice and heroism. Thank God they were there. There may never again be a time when all the layers of our complex society are so completely absorbed in such a monumental challenge as they were during World War II. Everyone had a role. Everyone understood that the successful outcome of the war was critical to the continuing evolution of political freedom. The nation was infused with a sense of purpose and patriotism. Political leaders, the popular culture, advertising, newspapers, and every other major sphere of influence cheered on the war effort once the fighting began. For many young men and women, that call to duty and the constant reminders of its importance marked their lives both during the fighting and long after. They brought home from the war fundamental lessons on the random nature of mortality, the gratification of entering into a common effort for the greater good, and the true reward of unconditional love of family. They also return mature beyond their years and eager to have a life of renewal and not destruction. John Chafee, who is retiring as a U.S. Senator from Rhode Island at the age of 76, was the son of a wealthy New England family when war broke out. He begins his story. I had had a wonderful freshman year at Yale, going there in September 1940, and had been on the wrestling team, which greatly attracted me. I was captain, and our team was undefeated, and I was undefeated. It was a big thing in my life. And the war was declared, and I was a sophomore wrestling on varsity at the time. But as deeply attached to wrestling as I was, I had no qualms about enlisting, even though I was in the ROTC and could have stayed there until I was commissioned. I decided to join the Marines, and why the Marines, I am not quite sure. Maybe it was that they had a big poster that showed a Marine coming off a beach with a rifle over his head saying, "First to fight, join the Marines." I went down to the recruiting office in Providence, Rhode Island, and signed up. My parents were quite enthusiastic about it. They didn't counsel against it at all. 6 months after he enlisted, Chafee was in the Pacific as a 19-year-old Marine private, armed with a Springfield rifle that had been designed about 40 years earlier. He asked for a combat assignment and was sent to Guadalcanal as part of the invasion to secure Henderson Field, a vital airstrip. Chafee was dug in when the Japanese counterattacked. He continues his story. The Japanese came down with tremendous precision and sank four cruisers, three American and one Australian. They just caught us napping. They came down at full speed at night. The Americans couldn't seem to handle things at night at that point. They switched on their lights and caught the Americans. Boom, boom. We were on the shore, and when those big guns shoot at night, you can follow the projectiles for a while because they come out red hot. We were leaping with excitement because we thought the Americans were whipping the Japanese. And the next morning, we saw what was left of the American vessels. I'll never forget the Coast Guard hauling in these Americans, the survivors, and they were just drenched with oil. So you didn't have to be a Phi Beta Kappa to know that we had not won that battle. So it dawned on everyone that we took a beating, and particularly when we saw that our four protective vessels were gone, and the supply vessels had left because they'd be easy prey to the Japanese, and we knew that there hadn't been much time for anything to be unloaded. We're thinking, hey, this is kind of lonely. Somebody once asked me, did you ever think the Japanese would chase you off Guadalcanal? It never occurred to me. I never even dreamed it, even after that. I don't know what we thought, but we weren't panicked. We just thought, well, that's today, but tomorrow's another day, and the United States is not just going to leave us here. In December, after 5 months at Guadalcanal, Chafee was selected for Officer Candidate School and returned to the U.S. for training at Quantico and at Fort Ritchie in Hagerstown. On June 14, 1944, he was commissioned a second lieutenant and then sent to Okinawa in May 1945. He continues, there, the fighting was fierce, but by this time we had wonderful equipment, way better than Guadalcanal. Okinawa was much more in the open, whereas it was more jungle fighting at Guadalcanal. It was different. I had a small unit. My job, as part of an intelligence unit, was to assess the frontline situation and report to my superiors by radio. On Okinawa, Chafee went through a combat experience that gave him a perspective on fate that guides him to this day. I remember we were going across a rice paddy, and they had these draining ditches that the farmers had made, and they were very narrow. But at least it was a ditch, maybe 12 or 14 inches deep. We started across this open rice paddy and got vigorously shelled by artillery. At this time, we were a rifle platoon moving forward, so there were maybe 40 in this group. On those occasions, you want to make yourself as small as possible, and everyone tried to squeeze into one of those ditches, which was tough going, but it made you feel better. I was squeezed into one of those ditches. It seemed like an eternity, but the shelling probably lasted only 10 minutes. Afterwards, the fellow who'd been in the ditch in front of me didn't get up, and I suddenly realized that he was dead. He was killed from the shelling. It's all luck. It just happened that I could have been the guy. I wasn't any better or braver or anything. It's just one of those things. For those who survived, World War II was the gateway to opportunities they might never before have imagined. The writer Paul Fussell says bluntly, World War II made America. It certainly changed the life of Miguel Encinas, who grew up in the 30s in New Mexico, a difficult time and place for working-class families, especially for poor Hispanics, who were treated as second-class citizens or worse. Yet when the war broke out, the Hispanic population responded with alacrity. Encinas wrote to tell his story of the war and its aftermath. In 1939, at age 16, when I was a junior in high school, I joined the New Mexico National Guard Combat Engineers Company. I served for a year before we were federalized on September 16, 1940. I always wanted to be a fighter pilot, but I was too young, and I didn't have 2 years of college. In early 1942, the standards were dropped to 18 and an intellectual test. That April, I would be 18 years of age. I became a Spitfire fighter pilot and flew combat missions for 9 months in Africa, Sicily, and northern Italy out of Corsica. On February 19, 1944, I was shot down and wounded over a German air base in Italy, about 100 miles north of the front line. I was captured immediately and became a POW and started my month's trip to Stalag Luft I on the Baltic coast, the only Hispanic among 10,000 officer aircrew members. After the war, I became a charter member of the D.C. Air Guard, flying the P-47 while attending Georgetown University, from which I graduated in 1949. Just as the Korean War was nearing, I left the squadron to study at the Institut d'Etudes Politiques in Paris. The war was on when I finished my year of graduate study. I went straight to Bolling Air Force Base and volunteered for active duty in Korea, where I flew the P-51 and later the F-86. I was shot down behind the lines and wounded on my 65th mission. We had helicopters then, and I was picked up and taken to a MASH hospital. After hospitalization elsewhere and convalescence leave, I went back to fly 46 more missions. When Vietnam came, I volunteered and flew a good bit of combat missions as an advisor to Vietnamese fighter pilots. In a later conversation, Encinas said that after he retired as a lieutenant colonel in 1971, he enrolled at the University of New Mexico, where he earned a Ph.D. in education and Spanish literature. He already had a master's degree in French from Middlebury College, courtesy of the Air Force. Wanting to use his degrees, as he put it, to give something back to the country and to the children, Colonel Encinas went from flying high-performance jets to a new job, as director of cross-cultural and language instruction for Albuquerque's public schools. He conducted teacher training seminars and developed performing arts activities to raise cultural awareness. In 1985, he returned to the University of New Mexico to design a curriculum more relevant to the large Hispanic student population. During his military career, Encinas flew more than 5,000 hours and earned 3 Distinguished Flying Crosses, 14 Air Medals, and 2 Purple Hearts. When The Greatest Generation was published, it had a striking photo on the cover, a couple standing next to a Jeep, his duffel bag nearby. Their embrace appeared to be a farewell embrace. I had several letters from couples saying it brought back memories of their own parting. Then the man who took the picture wrote, his name is Ozzie Sweet, and taking the photo launched him in a new direction. He went on to have a distinguished career as a magazine and sports photographer. Sweet, who had worked as an extra in Hopalong Cassidy movies before enlisting, explained how he got the idea for the picture from a dog on the base at Camp Callan in Southern California. I took the photo when I was still in basic training just because I thought it would be fun. It was taken with an old-time folding Kodak camera and a tripod that I borrowed. The dog, which belonged to a sergeant on the base, gave me the idea. He always looked so sad, and since it was a replacement center and GIs were being sent out every week, I thought it was a fitting picture. It was the thing of shipping out. That's a sad, sad time. There wasn't the glory connected with going off to war. It was a very sad thing. And of course, all the guys who did were very brave, but it wasn't a pleasant experience. So I have a special place in my heart for that photograph. The soldier in the picture was a friend of mine, and the thing was finding a girl with pretty legs. I found her at a dry cleaner's place on the base. It was just putting two people together, really. I told her what I was going to do, and she was willing to do it. No models fees then. It was always a favorite picture because it was my first to be published in any way. It was published in the Rangefinder, the Camp Callan newsletter, and then in one of the newspapers in San Diego. Then it was picked up by the picture services, and that's how it got around. So when it came time to be shipped out, I was transferred instead to the Signal Corps as a PR man, and that gave me lots of opportunities to take pictures. That's where my career started. It was that photograph that kept me from being shipped out, and it was that photograph that gave me all the opportunity to take pictures. If I'd been shipped out, I might not have had the career I did. Sweet, who now lives in New Hampshire, went on to shoot magazine cover photos of Albert Einstein, Ingrid Bergman, Helen Hayes, Grace Kelly, Dwight D. Eisenhower, John Wayne, Walt Disney, and Herbert Hoover, among others. His book on Mickey Mantle is considered a sports photography classic. Walter Morris was a military pioneer as a result of World War II. He was responsible for the formation of the first unit of black paratroopers. Morris, now retired in Florida, was a sergeant at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, with an all-black outfit. He remembers to this day the depressing effect of the worst kind of discrimination. While black soldiers were being banned from the post store, Italian and German prisoners of war who had been shipped into Fort Bragg were free to use the facility. In an interview with NBC News, Morris described how his men, who were engaged in guard duty, reacted to that egregious policy and what he decided to do about it. You automatically develop an inferiority complex. There must be something wrong with me if I can't ride in the front of the bus, and the only thing I can think of is the color of my skin, because I've gone to school. I put my pants on in the same way everyone else does. So it must be the color of my skin that causes this. And when you realize that, you're in a position where you are saying, what in the world can I do to overcome this? I saw the morale of my men at such a low ebb that they came off guard duty and we would go to the barracks and sleep all day. They had no initiative. And it occurred to me that as first sergeant of this company, I should do something about the low morale. And the idea came to me to imitate the white parachute students going through their calisthenics might be one way of uplifting our men. So we started at 4 o'clock every afternoon. When the white students would march off the field, the black students would march on the field. What Morris didn't know at the time is that in Washington, black leaders such as A. Philip Randolph and Roy Wilkins were putting pressure on President Roosevelt to develop a black paratroop outfit. At Fort Bragg, the commanding officer called Morris in and told him he would be the first member of what became a discrete unit, the 555th Parachute Battalion. Morris led a platoon of 16 fellow Negroes, as they were called then, who successfully completed their parachute training. In the Army, this platoon came to be known as the Sweet 16. Morris remembers their first jump. A lot of butterflies. A lot of anxiety. We were scared to death. But we couldn't show it because the whole world had their eyes on us and they were betting that we would not jump out of any airplane in flight. And we had to prove that we could do it. The worst-looking jump I have ever seen was our first jump. We were trained to jump with a proper attitude, which was knees together, slightly bent, the feet together, arms tight held. And when I look at the first jump we made, I have to laugh because it was nothing like the training we received. But it was improved. By the time we got to our fourth jump, we were looking pretty good. But we came out of the plane fast. We realize now that we were soldiers, not guard duty soldiers, not servants, not cooks. We were actually training for combat. We were going to be paratroopers, and that gave us all the incentive to succeed. The Sweet 16 were ready for combat. They received additional training in California, and they were sure they were headed to the Pacific in the closing days of war against Japan. Instead, with no advance warning, they were sent to the Pacific Northwest as smoke jumpers to fight forest fires started by Japanese incendiary balloons. Morris was deeply disappointed, As he prepared to jump into a fire in Washington State, he asked himself why he was doing this. And then he found the answer. It occurred to me that the reason I was doing it is because of my children and my children's children. And I knew I had in my heart that this country, as great as it is, would overcome the stigma of separation and prejudice, and, of course, we've come so long a ways from the 1945 era. In 1946, Walter Morris left the Army to return home to Seattle and learn his trade from his father, a bricklayer. Morris brought those skills to New York, where he became one of the first African Americans in the Bricklayers Union. He worked steadily on New York area construction projects until his retirement as superintendent of the Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Project in 1983. One of his daughters is a law professor at Howard University, and the other is a health department worker. He has a grandchild in the U.S. Army. How does Morris see his legacy as the first black military paratrooper? That we have succeeded where we were not expected to succeed, and we overcame the pitfalls that were put there. We overcame. And it's a warm feeling to know that color has nothing to do with it. It's what's in one's heart, one's spirit. And that should be a lesson to all of us. We should have, and we will have, a colorless society one day. And that will be the crowning jewel in this great country's history. The closing days of the 20th century and the renewed interest in the World War II era have prompted many veterans to return to the early impressions of life they described in letters home. Kay Voss, a retired businessman in Michigan, wrote the following. Let me start by saying that I am a part of the World War II generation. I served in the 8th Air Force as a co-pilot on a B-17, flying 31 missions. We came home to forget what hell we had gone through, and we all wanted to just get married, settle down, and live like normal people. I arrived home on Labor Day 1945 and was at work at my old job the very next day at 8 a.m. My father had a grocery and meat market in which I had worked from the age of 12. He and mother had a rough time while the war was going on. Help was hard to find, rationing, customers sometimes difficult to please when you didn't have what they wanted. Dad was more than happy to have me back. I can still remember how I felt those first few days. I was home. All those horrible days were behind me, and I was still alive. Anyone would have had to experience that to really know what I mean. I married my sweetheart shortly after and raised 4 wonderful children, 2 boys and 2 girls. The war was all behind me and as far out of my mind as I could put it. It wasn't until my parents had both passed away and we cleaned out their attic that I began to think much about my 8th Air Force days. For in a box, all bundled neatly according to date, I found every letter I had ever written to my folks clear through college and my 3 years or so in service, several hundred of them. The last of those letters reflects the unalloyed relief and joy servicemen and women everywhere must have felt in the summer of 1945. Hurrah, hurrah, I'm coming home. I may not be able to write again for a few days, so if my letters are rather scarce from now on for a while, you'll know why. I have lots to do and little time to do it. I haven't even started to pack. Everything is A-OK. All of us are so happy we can hardly keep our feet on the ground. I'm going to cut this short. Hope you'll forgive. See you real soon. Voss eventually took over his father's grocery business, and he stayed in that line of work until he retired in 1982. In his letter to me, he concluded with this passage. I remember the chapel service we attended just before our first mission. The chaplain prayed for our safe return, and the last song we sang, Be Still My Soul, returned to me many, many times in the uncertain days of combat. There seemed to be someone singing it to me. I like to think it was my mother, and she still does, from her heavenly choir. This has been a deeply satisfying personal journey for me. Reading the letters, hearing the stories, and sharing the emotional themes was a familial experience, intimate and nurturing. In this age of electronic communication overload, There is something reassuring and eloquent about a single voice speaking in direct, honest, and sometimes painful fashion about a passage when the future was measured day by difficult day. In a time of conspicuous self-indulgence, it is comforting to be absorbed in the lives of others who are selfless and grateful for whatever they have. Even those who were unhappy with oversights in The Greatest Generation made their points quietly and respectfully. As a final impression, I have chosen two different stories. One came to me while I was signing books in Big Timber, Montana, a favorite small town hard by the Yellowstone River. Betty Van Mulem gave me the letters her grandparents wrote to her uncles, their sons Raymond and James Todd, on the day the Japanese surrendered. Harry Todd and his wife Millie, in their western hamlet, spoke for America. The first letter is from Harry, who was treasurer of Golden County, Montana. "Dear boys, my emotions are so mixed, mingled with gladness and sadness, that I hardly know what to say to you tonight. All afternoon, we gathered about the radio in the sheriff's office about every quarter hour. Finally, about 3:30 p.m., National Broadcasting Company picked up Max Jordan at Bern, Switzerland, who said the text of Japan's reply was on the way to Washington, and we should have it in 2 hours. Talk about sweating it out. I smoked more cigarettes in the past 24 hours than I usually do in 3 days. Mom and I are so happy tonight, it's no use trying to tell you why, and a lot of stuff like that, but to be able to look forward to the time you are home again, and to be sure you are coming home, well, it just overwhelms me. I feel like getting out the Remington and burning up all the skeet shells you brought home, Jim. This little town has very few methods of making noise, but the fire bell and the Methodist church bell have rung out, and the sheriff went about town sounding his siren. The governor has proclaimed tomorrow and Thursday as holidays, and the president has designated Wednesday and Thursday for all government people as holidays. Stan called us up at about 5:30 this morning to tell us the war was over. However, it was announced from the White House at 5 p.m. Mountain Time today. From now on, I'm going to check off the days and weeks till you get home. Love, Dad." Their mother, Millie, was equally relieved and joyful. "Oh, darling, you will never know how happy your dad and mother are tonight. The past 4 days have been such a tense, nerve-wracking time. We have been having the radio on constantly day and night, and it seemed the news would never come. Papa and I are so thankful tonight that our Heavenly Father has spared our loved ones, and hope and pray they may be coming home to us soon. We do have so much to be thankful for, Raymond, that our family circle has not been broken, and how we pray you may be under the home roof soon. And while we are rejoicing, we cannot forget those who have loved ones who will not be coming home. There are many sorrowing, broken hearts tonight, while we are rejoicing. There are so many broken homes. May God comfort those broken hearts. There are many who have made the supreme sacrifice so that we have these happy homes of ours. To them, we owe much of our freedom. Love, Mom." The final letter and the final word is from Ruth Chamberlain, the grandmother of Jeremy Brunaccioni of Greenfield, Massachusetts. He sent the letter she wrote to her children on July 4, 1991. It is typical of the experiences of young couples across the nation, and the tone is also the voice of that generation. It is quietly matter of fact, and at the end, devoid of self-pity. She describes her romance with Roland, her husband, from the moment they met on an ice skating rink as teenagers. He had dropped out of school at the age of 16 to work in a shoe factory to help support his family. They went to a movie on December 7th, 1941. Sunday was a movie night, and we were sitting in the State Theater on Elm Street when the news of Pearl Harbor was flashed on the screen. I don't think there was a sound in the theater as all the uniformed men quietly arose and left a report to their post. The inevitable had arrived. We were at war. We were married the next spring, 1942, and Dad managed to be home until February 22, 1943. By then, I was pregnant 6 months and heartbroken when we saw him off at the train station. It was about 6 weeks before I heard from him and learned that he was at Camp Bliss in Texas near Austin for basic training. He was in the 365th Field Artillery Battalion attached to the 97th Infantry Division. To this day, his serial number, 312-66957, rolls readily from my lips. I wrote every day for 3 years except when having Nancy or the few times I saw him. In January of 44, he was stationed at Fort Leonard Wood in Missouri, and I could visit him there. When Dad thought he'd be stationed there, I returned home for Nancy. We went back out in April on an old train with wooden seats. Lots of standing room only, but a crazy young girl with an 11-month-old baby got preferred treatment. It took several days sitting there with a baby to bottle feed and change, and remember, no Pampers. I'll never figure out how I did it. Dumb, dumb luck. Had to wash all our clothes by hand. What diapers? Somehow managed all that alone. Got all the laundry on the line, and the clothesline broke, dropping everything into the red clay of Missouri. Dad made Staff Sergeant, and I was so proud. He was slated to go to OCS, Officer Candidate School, but by that time the war was getting worse with Japan, and in June, we had to come home because the outfit was going to California. They were shipped to Camp San Luis Obispo, California, and outfitted with hot weather gear. By then, the Battle of the Bulge in Belgium was waging, and they were needed in Europe instead. It's a wonder we won the war. So back they came to the East Coast in January 45 and headed for a brief stop in England, and then to Le Havre, France. By 1945, the Germans were really on the run, and General Patton was chasing them right into Berlin. The 197th was attached to his outfit, so Dad followed in his wake. Then came unconditional surrender in May 1945, and Alice and I celebrated on Elm Street with thousands of others. What joy! We still had Japan to contend with, so he ended up in Bremerton, Washington, and boarded a ship for Japan. The day they sailed, Japan also surrendered, but of course, the ship sailed on. In February of 1946, exactly 3 years after being called, he returned home for good. There was a time of getting reacquainted and readjusted to a normal way of life. A whole chunk of 3 years out of our lives and apart. So ended the saga. Any questions? Mom.
Another title by Tom Brokaw, available on audio from Random House, is The Greatest Generation, read by the author. This has been a Random House audiobooks presentation. Production copyright 1999 Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.